The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
And it's time now for the Culture Club. We're delighted to be joined today by Christine Dwyer Hickey, who has published her latest novel, Our London Lives, which, if I'm correct, Christine, is your 10th book, is it?
Yes, my 10th book.
And what's this one about?
It's set in London and it's kind of about two lost souls who find each other over a long period of time, find and lose each other over a period of time. And it's also sort of about London as well. London will be the third character. And really, it's about the people. If I tell you what the story's about, I give away too much and I'd be given out to. So it's really about the people and how they think and feel and how they're in this vast city that they feel, you can feel very lonely and isolated, but at the same time, they find refuge there for different reasons. He's a boxer, failed boxer, and she's a barmaid. And that's all I can tell you really for the moment.
Okay, well, tell me a bit more about London, because I believe you went to live there for a period to help you in your research for the book.
I dragged my poor unfortunate husband over and we stayed for 4 months, much to the horror of our grown-up children. They're just jealous, I think. And we rented a flat over there. We rented two different flats, actually, and just got to spend time there and walk the streets and listen to people and, you know, talk to people. And we were there around the time of Brexit, 2017. And my husband's a great man for interviewing people on the bus and in supermarkets. How do you feel about Brexit and all this stuff? But we had a great time. We really had a ball, I have to say. I loved it.
That doesn't sound like work at all. Research under the guise of a four-month holiday.
Well, yeah, you could say that too. But no, I did get up very early in the morning and I would only do an hour of writing impressions and things that I'd, you know, picked up from the previous day, say. And you need, it was kind of boots on the ground stuff. You need, kind of needed to be there, I felt. I mean, I was a bit scared of taking on a city like London. I was quite daunted by it. And, you know, when you look at the writers who've taken on London before. And then I decided that it's sort of a series of villages really stuck together with the river going up it like a spine. So we just picked a couple of villages and got to know them very, very well indeed. So took it from there. And I had a great time. Went to a boxing club, got to know the boxers there, even got into the ring with one of the boxers.
Oh, what do you mean you got into the ring with one of the boxers?
I did, yeah. I went, there's a fella called Mickey Delaney and he's sort of, I think he's second generation Irish, real Londoner, real London accent. He's about 80 years of age now. And all his old cronies all have real Irish names, but they all have the London thing going on, you know. So anyway, we met, happened to bump into another man from Galway who brought us down there to his club, the Dale Boxing Club, Dale Youth Boxing Club. And it was part of the Grenfell Tower. They just had got a new club set in under in the basement of the Grenfell Tower. And they'd only been there 2 weeks and it went up with the fire.
We've only been talking about the Grenfell Fire today in the programme on a couple of occasions.
Yeah, it's dreadful. It's dreadful. But anyway, they luckily enough, it was late at night, so there was nobody in it. But they lost all that. And then they went about rebuilding and finding a new site and Prince William and all that got involved in it. But Mickey Delaney, when you go and you see him and you meet him and you see the respect the kids have for him and the younger men have for him, and it was one of the best experiences of my life getting to know them. You know, you're in the middle of all these guys, the older ones, and they're talking about the prisons they went to, the way other people talk about what schools they went to. And they, you know, at one point I just wanted to give up everything and go on the road with them and make their sandwiches and their tea forever, because there's just no pretension about them and they're real gentlemen in their own way. But anyway, I wanted to know what it was like to be in the ring. So one fella with a scar going from the top of his head down to his jaw got me in the ring. His job is, believe it or not, his job is to train women to hit their husbands back if they hit them. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
So he trains women to do this. So he got in and of course I was like the paper bag, you know, trying to, you know, with the weight of the gloves even were sort of weighing me down.
And I presume headgear and mouth guard
and
everything.
Just had the gloves on and he was doing the pad work, as we say in the business, that we're doing the pad work. And he was slagging me and laughing at me, but he took his eye off the ball for a minute. So I got one belt in that he wasn't expecting, which was great.
Why, was it a low blow?
It was quite a low blow. Just you know, above a below blow. So anyway, but it was great fun. And then Mickey Delaney got in with me and he kind of took it a bit slower and he took me very seriously. And So we're having a launch in London next week, and I'm looking forward to meeting
some
him there.
Some characters will be at the launch.
Yeah, yeah, they will, yeah.
Excellent. So. Okay, well, I'm looking forward to reading our London lives. Just tell me one more thing about it. Is it sort of like really the experience of the Irish amongst the Irish community in London, or is it different to that?
No, they kind of it's seen only it's a very big book and there's a lot of characters in it, but it's seen from the perspective of just the two people, Pip, the guy who's actually half Irish. They don't belong in the Irish community and they don't belong in the English community, so they're real outsiders. But they observe everything that's going on around them.
Okay, I'm looking forward to reading it, Our London Lives. So, Christine, let's go to your Culture Club choices. And you definitely have a very different first single recollection of buying or having an impact to anything we've had on the programme before. You're the first person to nominate the great Luke Kelly and the song Paddy on the Railway.
That's right.
Tell us about it.
So, well, I know there's... I'm often asked about my childhood on foot of the book I wrote called Tatty. And, you know, people just presume that everything about my childhood was unhappy. But there was a lot of happy moments, too. And, you know, when we were kids, we went to, I remember we spent a few holidays in Greystones of all places, you know, but renting a house for a month, which we absolutely wrecked. We left it destroyed by the time we were finished it. And we had a great time there. But my eldest brother, Anthony, has special needs. And he was a very, very slow to develop. But around this time of this memory, he was beginning to make more, he was beginning to communicate better, and he loved music and he loved Luke Kelly, who was a regular visitor to our house. And when we were in Greystones, every time we went onto the railway bridge, he would shout out, Paddy on the Railway. And I remember that, and we'd be in the car, say, and we'd all have to sing the song. And I can remember sensing the joy from my parents, but tinged with sadness too, that he had come on so well, you know. So that's why I love the song.
Let's hear a bit of it.
In 1841, me corduroy breeches I put on. Me corduroy breeches I put on to work upon the railway, the railway. I'm weary of the Paddy works on the railway. In 1842, from Hartlepool I moved to Crewe, and I found myself a job to do, working on the railway. I was wearing corduroy bridges, digging ditches, pulling switches, dodging hitches. I was working on the railway. In 1843, I broke my shovel across me knee, and I went to work for the company on the Leeds and Selby Railway. I was wearing corduroy bridges, digging ditches.
I actually passed the Luke Kelly statue or the memorial to him down in the North Wall last week on the way up to Croke Park, and I was trying to explain to a couple of my daughters who Luke Kelly was. I now know what music to give them to listen to now as well.
He's some singer, isn't he?
He was an incredible voice.
Wonderful voice, yeah.
And some character as well, if you knew him.
Yeah, he was a bit of a character, all right.
Okay, favourite album? You've given us a couple. The first one, Schubert.
Schubert's Impromptu. Like when I'm... between books, between novels, if I'm changing, or even when I have to change the perspective of it within a novel when I'm working, I like to clear the decks a bit. And I use this fourth impromptu because it sounds like running water. So you really literally feel as if you're cleaning your brain out. And when we hear it now, you'll see what I mean. But I just think it opens up something. I use classical music a lot to help me with the creative side, to open up the creative side of my brain. And I don't know why more people don't do that. But especially if you're in a car, I love it when you're in a car because you've the movement, you've the music, and you've got the movement. And certain music really makes you think about what you're seeing outside. You see people moving in. With the movement, in step, like Handel or Mozart or any of those will do that. And they help you to think something. It just switches on some little part of your brain that might be having a little snooze. And I often find when I listen to Schubert, problems that I've had about the novel or about whatever I'm working on kind of rectify themselves. So that's why I love this piece.
This may be the first time on Today FM that we're going to hear a bit of Schubert's Impromptu number 4.
Thank you.
That's Schubert, putting us in a more mellow mood.
Pretty nice, isn't it?
Indeed.
Am I the uncoolest person you've ever had on the
far
show?
From it. Far from it, Christine. Okay, tell us about your other album choice, though. Neil Young's Old Man.
Yeah, that the same thing. I love listening in the car, and some music really suits a particular landscape. And I remember being on a book tour in Canada and driving through Ontario, which is really flat, and listening to Neil Young, and it just suddenly comes, oh yeah, he's Canadian, and that's why it sounds so good here. But while I was writing this, I used Old Man. I like to have a piece of music that's like a soundtrack, not just to the novel, but to a particular character. So if I get into the car, put that on, whatever problems I'm having with that character, it ignites it in my head and I can figure it out. So this was for Pip, and I love the banjo bit. I hope we have time to hear the banjo interlude, because it's so intense and tightly controlled, and yet it just flows beautifully.
We do, which I believe was played by James Taylor. So let's hear it.
All right. Okay, good.
Old man, look at my life. 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two. Love lost, such a cost. Give me things that don't get lost, like a coin that won't get tossed, rolling home to you.
That's wonderful, Neil Young's Old Man. I haven't heard that in years, yeah, and it is terrific. It's a great choice. Mm. Best gig you were at?
Well, no, I was never much of a gig goer. My husband brought me to a Pink Floyd concert in Rome once, and I nearly fell asleep until a riot broke out and the cops were out on the horses. And we had to vault over the wall in order to escape. And not fully understanding what a gig entailed, I had arrived in heels and a short skirt. But I managed to jump that wall, and my husband was always dead impressed that I did so without showing the merest flash of knickers.
How come that's not your best gig?
Well, anyway, I just thought my favourite gig, though, was Frank Sinatra. Again, you know, I'm not being very cool, I suppose. But
isn't Frank Sinatra the epitome of cool?
I think he is. I think he is, actually. But anyway, it was in Lansdowne Road back in the 80s, and I bought the tickets, spent a week's wages to buy the tickets, to make up for a row I'd had with my husband about my bad management of money, would you believe? So anyway, he took it in good heart and we went.
Now, this wasn't just Frank Sinatra, wasn't that the time when you had Liza Minnelli Sammy Davis Jr. with him?
And they were very good. He bounced around the stage and she was sort of dripping with emotion, but she was great. They were great, the two of them. But when Mr. Cool strode on, and the way he worked his band and just the things he said, and when he played I've Got You Under My Skin, oh, he was just to die for. He was brilliant.
We don't have any clip from Lansdowne Road, but here they are in a performance on the same tour in Japan.
All right.
Come with me, that's where we belong, Liza. That's
my little town. Sing it. They are so away.
If I remember rightly from 1989, there was about as much fuss made then as it was this year of Taylor Swift coming, or Coldplay or Oasis coming next year. And of course, we know about the rows about ticket prices. How expensive were the tickets back in 1989?
I think they cost me 80 something quid or something.
That was an awful lot of money back then.
It was an awful lot of money.
I think they just did the one night, didn't they?
I think it was only one night. I can't remember, to be honest.
Yeah, and it was...
But I was thrilled that I got... They're very easy to get, though. They were easy to get. I suppose the 80s, they were easy
very
to get.
Very few people had money in the 80s to go to concerts.
Yes. The place was packed. And we went into the hotel afterwards, packed. What was the name of that? The Berkeley Court Hotel. Went in there after absolutely packed. We had a brilliant night. You can even hear. He'd passed his prime, I suppose, but the quality of his voice is still there. You can hear it.
Favourite play or musical? Give us your favourite play first.
My favourite play is The Faith Healer, and I was very fortunate that I saw the Donal McCann version in the Gay Theatre. It's really, it's a terrifying play, and it's really, really strong. It's very
Why
strong.
Is it terrifying?
There's just something so dark about it, and how I think that Frank Hardy, this effect he has on people, and that he can destroy their lives without really meaning to. He's just such a dark, dark character. And I also love the way it was structured. You've got three different versions of the same story, which is very, very simple premise, really, because that happens even in Chinese Whispers, even any story that you tell within a family, people would have
different versions, their own realities.
Same story, yeah. But the way Friel structured it and built it up slowly, you could hardly breathe while you were watching it. It was a terrific, terrific performance.
So that's Faith Healer by Brian Friel. And a musical.
The musical, now. When my father worked as a contractor, and he did a lot of the contracts for the race courses usually and stud farms. But this particular time he had the contract for the American embassy, and he made friends with the ambassador. So I presume the ambassador liked the horses, because most of my father's, nearly all of his close friends liked to have a bet. And anyway, when the ambassador was posted elsewhere, he gave him a present of a big walnut, beautiful, beautiful walnut record player.
I thought you were going to say horse for
no,
a second.
That would be lovely, wouldn't it? And the lid slowly came down, which we were fascinated as kids, watching the lid come down. You know, you just tipped it and it came down.
Yeah.
And plus two huge boxes of LPs. And these LPs had, it was probably every LP that was ever cut in the States, classical, jazz, musicals. And they had enticing titles like Pearl Bailey Sings for Adults Only, with a picture of Pearl on the front and a mink coat, and I suspect nothing else on underneath that. Or Songs for Swinging Lovers, which would mean something completely different now, of course. But anyway, they also had every musical. So I have four brothers, the youngest wasn't born then, but I used to bash them into playing the musicals, and they'd have to take the parts. But the King and I was popular because the Waltz of the Siamese Children, because there was lots of noise and pot lid bashing, and they much preferred that to, say, being forced to be Gretel and Lisa from The Sound of Music. So that's why I like that, the joy of it and banging the pots and making plenty of noise.
Let's hear a little bit of The King and I. Even I recognise that. The March of the Siamese Children, that's the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra from a cast recording of the 1992 stage show The King and I. And let's move on to favourite movies or actors or directors. And you've given us Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. Why so?
I love the film. I've seen it more than any other film, I'd say. And on the surface, it just looks like it's a very warm, feel-good family Christmas movie. But I actually think there's so many layers to it, and his performance is so good in it. I think that it shows us just how the smallest of us can have such an effect on other people's lives, and we can make such a big difference to everybody. And also it contains one of the most passionate and romantic scenes in it. If you recall the bit where he's on the phone with the character played by Donna Reed, and they are sharing the receiver of the phone while they make a phone call. They were having a phone conversation with somebody else. And gradually we see how he intends going away. He's always going to go away, but he never actually gets away. And how he gradually, his feelings, he becomes overwhelmed by the man. He drops the phone and he grabs her. And it's a wonderful scene, I think. And I just love it. I think it's a great, great old film.
That's not the scene we have, though. The
Is
scene
it not?
That we have is where Clarence, the guardian angel, played by Henry Travers, shows James Stewart's character, George, a world without a minute.
Right.
Are you sure this is Bailey Park?
No, I'm not sure of anything anymore. All I know is this should be Bailey Park. But where are the houses?
We weren't here to build them. Your brother, Harry Bailey, broke through the ice and was drowned at the age of 9.
That's a lie. Harry Bailey went to war. He got the Congressional Medal of Honor. He saved the lives of every man on that transport.
Every man on that transport died. Harry wasn't there to save them because you weren't there to save Harry. You see, George, you really had a wonderful life. Don't you see what a mistake it would be to throw it away?
Clarence?
Yes, George?
Where's Mary?
Oh, well, I can't...
I don't know how you know these things, but tell me, where is she? If you know where she is, tell me where my wife is.
I'm not supposed to tell.
Please, Clarence, tell me where she is.
You're not going to like it, George.
Where is she?
She's an old maid. She never married.
Where is Mary? Where is she? Where is she?
She's just about to close up the library. There must be some easier way for me to get my wings.
And the worst thing that could happen, of course, is that she'd end up being an old maid working in a library.
Okay, let's move on to favourite books, which is always a difficult one for authors to pick a book. But you've done something interesting. You've picked for us what you call city books.
Mm.
Why is
that? I love city books. I love cities. And I've picked my three favourite city books. So Ulysses by James Joyce, Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, and more recently, A Star Called Henry by Roddy Doyle. And I mean, Ulysses, there's so much that can be said about that. But I think, as Joyce predicted, even the parts of Dublin that have since disappeared can always be recalled by this novel. So it's sort of like a social document in a way. And I love Mrs. Dalloway because London in a single day in June 1923 flows through the mind of one woman, her surroundings, her past, the party she plans for that evening. It's all in beautiful prose. And I love A Star Called Henry because it peels back the city of Dublin and we can see it from the top of buildings and from below. You know, we see it looking up from the secret rivers under the ground. And we can see it every which way it can be seen. And I also love almost anything by Dickens as well for that reason. It's just the life and the effect that the city has on me. It's just the way.
Well, we have a clip from the audiobook for Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf.
Okay.
For having lived in Westminster how many years now? Over 20. One feels, even in the midst of the traffic or waking at night, Clarissa was positive. A particular hush or solemnity, an indescribable pause, a suspense. But that might be her heart, affected, they said, by influenza, before Big Ben strikes. There. Out it boomed. First a warning, musical, then the hour. Irrevocable. The leaden circles dissolved in the air. Such fools we are, she thought, crossing Victoria Street. For heaven only knows why one loves it so, how one sees it so, making it up, building it round one, tumbling it, creating it every moment afresh. But the veriest frumps, the most dejected of miseries sitting on doorsteps, drink their downfall, do the same. Can't be dealt with, she felt positive, by Acts of Parliament for that very reason. They love life. In people's eyes, in the swing, tramp and trudge, in the bellow and the uproar, the carriages, motor cars, omnibuses, vans, sandwich men shuffling and swinging, brass bands, barrel organs, in the triumph and the jingle and the strange high singing of some aeroplane overhead, was what she loved. Life. London, this moment of June.
Virginia Woolf. Okay. So, television, as a child, what do you remember?
Well, Pippi Longstrumpf, or Pippi Longstocking, as it was known here, she had the same colour of hair as I had, which is hair that gets you get into trouble. You're always identifiable in a crowd. You know, people would say the one with the reddish hair or the one with the red hair. But I totally related to her, and I actually used to straighten out a wire clothes hanger and put it in my hair so I could put the plaits around it and they'd stick up the same way. But she was great. And I loved I Dream of Jeannie, and I loved the Mr. Ed, the talking horse. And actually, I've seen them in reruns and they're still brilliant. I still think they're great. I really loved the Partridge Family. And I was sure I was going to marry David Cassidy. And I even gave up Davy Jones and the Monkees for him, but sure, it didn't work out. But anyway, and I love telly. I love the telly.
And then as an adult, you've actually picked a series that doesn't get mentioned much, but I really enjoyed the first couple of series of it. And I never finished it out, and I must go back and finish it out. Babylon Berlin.
Oh yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's set during the end of the Weimar Republic, so in the late 20s, and it's kind of like a thriller, romance, spy.
With great music as well.
Great music, but it's really dark in many, many ways. Like, that shows real poverty and the seediness of Berlin during the wars. But it also, then the light comes in then with the music and the dancing. The dancing's brilliant in it. And Brian Ferry then suitably spooky at the end of it. Oh, it's fantastic. It's really an unusual experience to watch it. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Your other choices?
Mad Men. I thought Mad Men was brilliant. I love these well-made series that have great characters and dialogue, and The Wire, and they take you, again, cities.
Into Baltimore, which is pretty grim.
Yeah.
We actually have a clip from Mad Men, which also, of course, New York is very much Madison Avenue advertising. Yeah. Here's a clip, and we talk about dialogue. This is where Don Draper, played by John Hamm, finds a way to get around cigarette advertising restrictions.
Yeah. Gentlemen, before you leave, can I just say something?
I don't know, Don. Can you?
The Federal Trade Commission and Reader's Digest have done you a favor. They've let you know that any ad that brings up the concept of cigarettes and health together, well, it's just going to make people think of cancer.
Yes, and we're grateful to them.
But what Lee Jr. said is right. If you can't make those health claims, neither can your competitors.
So, we got a lot of people not saying anything that sells cigarettes.
Not exactly. This is the greatest advertising opportunity since the invention of cereal. We have six identical companies making six identical products. We can say anything we want. How do you make your cigarettes?
I don't know.
Shame on you. We breed insect repellent tobacco seeds, plant them in the North Carolina sunshine, grow it, cut it, cure it, toast it.
What? There you go. There you go.
But everybody else's tobacco is toasted.
No, everybody else's tobacco is poisonous. Lucky Strikes is toasted.
Brilliant.
It's a terrific series.
It. Yeah, it's a terrific series. I often think of it, actually. I saw it again about 2 years ago. I watched it from the top again. I thought it was great. So you see more the second time.
You do. I've done the same.
Yeah.
Okay, Buried Treasure to finish off Christine Dwyer Hickey. Something we don't have a clip for. It's an epic poem, I think, isn't it?
It's The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. I often learn poetry off by heart when my mind is in a bit of a panic, and I think it's a handy thing.
Why did you do that?
It soothes you. It stops you thinking of too much about things. But anyway, I've used it like for a trauma. It's great whether you're in the dentist chair or in the labour ward. You can just recite the poem and take it, and you say to yourself, when this is over, when this is out of my head, this particular thing will be finished. She'll have the tooth out or the tooth filled or the baby be here, whatever.
And the wasteland goes on quite a bit, doesn't it?
It goes on quite a bit. But during COVID, during lockdown, the first lockdown, I was very worried. My daughter was expecting a baby and I couldn't see her. We weren't allowed to travel more than the 5K. And I was worried about my special needs brother, Toto, or Tony. And I was also worried about myself because I have an autoimmune condition, and we didn't know how vaccines at the stage. We didn't know what was happening. We were still giving our messages a bath when we brought them, when my husband had to go and buy them, and we'd have to disinfect them and eat before you'd eat anything. But anyway, I started to learn The Wasteland off by heart. It's 434 lines long, would you believe? Now, I was writing the novel set in London at the time. I'd add one line on, you know, a night and then carry that around and say it, and then it gradually built up. And I was writing the novel set in London, and a few little things started to look a bit familiar, and I said, oh God, don't tell me I'm stitching the bits of The Wasteland in unknown to myself. I'd be sued. So then what I decided to do was to give it to one of the characters. So I gave it to Pip when he's going through a very rough patch, and he's actually in prison, and he learns The Wasteland off by heart. He couldn't carry it around with him because the other wouldn't go down too well with the other prisoners. So he learns it off by heart. So that way, when there were any leakages, it seemed more natural. It seemed natural. So,
What is The Wasteland? It just brings you a sense of peace.
There's a sense of it was written in the, I think it was published in 1923, maybe, no, in the early 20s anyway. And it was written when Eliot himself was going through a very bad time, and after the First World War, the effects of the First World War were being felt by everybody. And there was a sense of desolation, I think. And there is that quietness, and it travels. I like that one, that it kind of goes to different territories around London and sometimes off into the space. You don't know where it is, you know. And then it's also funny in ways, and it's just different accents. And oh no, I think it's a wonderful piece of work.
Do you still remember it?
I remember, yeah, I think so. I'd have
give
to
give us a few lines.
Oh no, I
you?
Couldn't. I'd be mortified. I, God, I didn't think. Which ones will I give? Which ones will I give? Well, I'll give you the beginning.
Go for it.
Well, if I make a mistake now, to delete.
Well, I won't know. I won't be able to correct you. The listeners okay. might be able to, but you won't hear them.
Okay. April is the cruelest month, reading lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth with forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us. Coming over the Starnberger See with a shower of rain, we stepped into a colonnade and went down in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour.
There's a job for you in doing readings of T.S. Eliot and The Wasteland.
I'm glad you stopped me there because the next bit was German.
Christine Dwyer Hickey, thank you so much for joining us for the Culture Club, and look forward to reading Our London Lives.
Okay.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.